The subject is the permanent capability, the permanent war machine that has been created, in fact, was created right after World War II. Have you, since this film, it's not a radical position. It's a position that Dwight David Eisenhower, in the final days of his administration, said was in existence and getting more pernicious by the day. So I don't think there's anybody, even in the far right, who would disagree with that position. But since the film has been seen, and it's been seen quite a lot since it first was shown in Sundance, at least in the festival circuit, I mean, have you had anybody come up to you, you know, and just take basic issue with what the film says?
I really haven't. I mean, I think one of the things that's hopefully unique about the film is that it is very nonpartisan, and that it really tries to look at a subject that is of common concern to all of us. It really isn't a film that that tries to polarize, and I that is the case because I'm that way as a person, and I think so many of us are. You know, America is dominated right now by Washington and the way that Washington sort of exploits our differences. And the reason Washington does that is it's a two-party town, and the more similar the parties get, and we all see that on some fundamental levels like the war in Iraq and some other places, they're getting all too similar. But because they're getting similar, they need what any brand name product needs. They need brand name recognition. And so in order to drum up a sense of reason to vote for one party or another, they play on our differences, things about sex and race and class and things like this, while really the name of the game in Washington is that all politicians, no matter what party they're in, are beholden to special interests in a way that is gradually eroding the very heart of our democracy.
Yeah.
And nobody is to blame for this. This is a systemic crisis that everybody's wrapped up in. And because I come at it without an agenda that says this party's good and that party's bad, you know, I'm often heard saying that Republicans don't own the copyright on war in America. You need only look at the wars of the 20th century to see that a disproportionate number of them, in fact, have been run by Democrats. And as we saw, the Democrats were supportive of the war in Iraq. And all too often, when we see the issues about special interests, we're seeing the Abramoff scandal right now, and many people would like to think, oh, good, it's a Republican issue. Well, it really isn't. It's an across-the-board issue, and Abramoff is only one indication of a town which itself is crumbling from within in its moral and ethical framework. Mm-hmm. When people understand that that's what I'm on about, and that I'm on about something that would really safeguard all that we all hold dear, no matter what our party stripe is, I think we find that people find harmony in the film, and they find a chance in the film to think more deeply and not get caught up in that old party game. We don't have time for that anymore.
I don't think I asked you this before, but I'm kind of curious about how you happen to settle. You have a kind of a common man voice in this, someone who's not from a government agency or a think tank, and his name is Wilton Sexer.
Exactly.
And how did you happen to? He's a man who lost one of his sons in 9/11. And he's a, I'm trying to remember, Gene, it's been a while, but he's a cop or an ex-cop or
yep.
a part?
Yeah. Wilton is was a New York City cop, and before that he'd been a Vietnam veteran and spent his life in the service of his country, and is a very, very patriotic American and a lovely man who is has become an extremely remarkable friend to me. But at the very beginning, I didn't know Wilton at all, and in fact, the only reason I came to know of him is that in a former life, when I wasn't making movies, I had worked at a private company in the World Trade Center, just a business company, in the World Trade Center, and so I'd had occasion at that time to know friends and know people who were working in the building. And after I left to move on with my life and to actually go and make movies, I ended up in a situation where I lost friends on 9/11, and people who had stayed in the building who I knew had not been fortunate enough to be elsewhere. And because of that, I was on a number of family newsletters of people who had lost loved ones in 9/11, and Wilton's name and his story, to some extent, appeared on one of those newsletters.
Yeah. I thought it was particularly, you know what I particularly liked, in addition, obviously, to the keynote address delivered by President Eisenhower, that you spoke to his daughter, Susan. And I thought it was particularly intriguing that she noted at one point that her dad saw this the development of the military industrial complex right after World War II. I mean, it pretty much that's when it that really began to take hold. And it really was she reluctant to say this? Was she has she always been? I mean, it seems to me that family members of deceased of presidents, politicians, they always seem a little I don't know, a little hesitant to be as plain spoken as she was. And I was very impressed by what she said.
I've been incredibly impressed by Susan Eisenhower, who is a remarkable scholar. And really a remarkable person of enormous intellectual depth and courage. And I think that when I first met her and when I first met her father, John, you're captivated immediately that there is a kind of deep thinking that goes on in the Eisenhower family, and I don't know if it's genetic or if it's part of the old Quaker training that in which Dwight Eisenhower was raised, but these are very thoughtful people who don't speak out of school and who don't take this country lightly. They take it very seriously, and as Susan Eisenhower often told me, her grandfather really created a tradition of looking deeply at his country with the kind of tough love that even is willing to look critically. And she once said to me that she worries very much when we enter a time in which everything we do is right and nothing we do is wrong. And it's that kind of willingness to look deeply that is so inspiring from Susan Eisenhower, from John Eisenhower, and of course from the man himself, Dwight Eisenhower.
Now the film, again alluding to my admiration for the way the film is put together, but it has a wonderful opening montage that it really zotzes the thing right home, and it just gets you from the get go. Do you how are you as an editor? I mean, what's your process? Do you work with the same guy who worked with you on the trials of Henry Kissinger? How do you? I mean, it's just a really nicely cut film, and I just
the editor on the film is Nancy Kennedy, who is just a supreme thinker and a remarkable editor.
Yeah.
And I had the great fortune. This was the first film I ever made with Nancy, and it was really a remarkable experience in collaboration, because Nancy is somebody who, I would say, the very best things in the film were really moments of beautiful epiphany, where Nancy was left to her own devices in a dark room with four walls and no windows, and I would go away to do something else on the movie, and I would come back and something of pure beauty would have emerged on the editing table. And I'd love to take credit for those things, but I just can't. They are a product of a very good working relationship between editor and director. And the subject also really compelled us into some interesting contortions in the editing process. I think that the film is potentially a bit schizophrenic. You know, we started to make a film that was really a look at Eisenhower's prophecy 40 years on. Where are we? Has his warning about the military-industrial complex come to pass in a world where all we hear about are defense contracts and exploding budgets and exploding bombs? And then suddenly a war happened, the war in Iraq, where we hadn't, it's not that we hadn't anticipated that, we knew it might happen, but once it was upon us, you couldn't make a theoretical film about war anymore. You had to deal with the very war that was unfolding across the sea, and there was no way to ignore that. It was affecting everyday people, their lives at home and here.
Mm-hmm.
And so basically, that meant that we had to make a human film as well. And there was an inherent schizophrenia to trying to make both a human film and a theoretical film and bring those two kinds of filmmaking together. And it was that very weaving process that was most challenging, but I think most rewarding for the film.
I think that one of the films that one of the aspects of the film that people respect in particular is that you don't just speak to lefties, but you've got John McCain as a one of your significant talking heads, and also a big Washington conservative named William Kristol, Kristol. But if I were they, and I were approached by a guy who had done something that was pretty damning as far as the sum total of Henry Kissinger's life, I might be a little cautious, but I thought it was great that you got those guys. Was there any trouble in getting them to talk to you? Or
I was very, very pleased that virtually everybody we went out to interview or to meet with about the film were very, very open with us. And I think they were, and I'd hope to think, that it's because people sensed that what we were trying to do was truly something that was trying to take a very deep and long-term look at an America we all love and that we all hope the best for. And that in that positive effort, there would be critical material. There would be an effort to look deeply and to get behind some of the mythologies that dominate our lives. But I think everybody was struck with the responsibility that we were taking on, and that we were planning to do so in an extremely rigorous way. And I was given a great deal of trust by the people who spoke to us, and I hope I honored that trust. I think I did.
Were there any guys on the right side of the spectrum whom you wanted to speak to but begged off out of concern that in some way that they wouldn't, their views wouldn't be represented fairly or whatever?
We didn't have anyone who took that position. We had only one interview that ended up being canceled on us, and that was because we had booked an interview with Paul Wolfowitz, who was then under Donald Rumsfeld at the Pentagon before he went to the World Bank. And we had the interview booked. We were delighted. It was an interview I was very much looking forward to. Paul Wolfowitz was appearing in the film in television clips and other ways, and I really wanted to hear directly from him about some of the questions I was considering. And I have to say that on the morning that the Abu Ghraib story broke, we got a phone call from the press secretary who handles affairs for the Pentagon, who alerted us that a moratorium had been set on a lockdown on communications between Pentagon and representatives and the vice president's office and the media. And so we lost our opportunity to talk to Mr. Wolfowitz because of the Abu Ghraib scandal.
Given the enormous respect and admiration for this film that is virtually anybody I've spoken to who has seen it, and it seems particularly sad to me, unfortunate, that it's not a contender for the best feature documentary Oscar, which it easily would be. It would certainly be on that short list that was announced in November, had there not been this slight problem that came about because of a TV airing, I believe, was it Switzerland or was it Belgium?
It was the BBC.
BBC. Now, you're a smart guy, and the Sony Classics guys are smart guys. I mean, you know the ropes as well as any seasoned pro in this town. Did this just happen accidentally? I mean, it seems a shame that it happened, because it just, you know, it adds to the allure of a film like yours to
right.
be one of the, you know, one of the Oscar-nominated films, and it could, in my mind, I don't think there'd be any question that it would be up, you know, one of the five, at least.
Right. Well, there's no question. I mean, we were very sorry about it, and what happened is a slightly complicated story, but it's kind of interesting. Right at the time where the film won Sundance last year, the Academy issued a press release announcing new rules for documentaries, and that the rules had been changed to be more forgiving on certain documentaries that were coming to America from television, both overseas and here at home. Because in prior years, films like Control Room and others had, though they were hugely popular with the public and seen critically as very, very worthy films, they had been deemed ineligible as well. And so the Academy let it be known that they were looking to correct a problem, which is that often films that come out in America that are really U.S. theatrical films have to go abroad for some of their funding, as mine did. And you have to do that because this country, tragically, is a kind of shrinking landscape for ideas. It's harder and harder to get politically challenging material, controversial material like that in our film, funded. And so someone like me has to go abroad. And it's a sad statement about where we are, but it's just a reality. And so when you go abroad, the problem is that broadcasters overseas who give you the money, they're public broadcasters, and there is funding for that, they want to show your film. And they want to show it because they've just partly paid for it. And so the Academy looked to correct this problem because they were seeing that very worthy films that really, when they opened in America, were purely theatrical films. They weren't coming out on TV here first. They weren't coming out shortly thereafter on TV. They're very much U.S. theatrical films. That what was happening was that they were missing, the Academy was missing out on these. The Academy was ending up not being representative of the really the best of the best, necessarily. And so they announced a change in the rules. And we were very delighted to hear that. And we looked up the rules online, and the BBC looked up on the rules online. And what happened at that moment is just an unfortunate misunderstanding where it was clear that the Academy intended to change the rules in a way that was that seemed to many of us in the industry, ourselves, Sony, Sundance Institute, and many others who we spoke to, all thought that the rules had been changed to make a film like ours eligible, and that it was okay that it would be broadcast in England so long as it had what the Academy called a bona fide theatrical release here in the United States. We are going to have a very wide release here in the United States, and we knew that at the time, so we thought, well, that is the new rule, is that that's now what prevails. As it turns out, in the months since, we've learned that that wasn't really exactly the Academy's intention. And so my main feeling about this is that, and we tried to persuade the Academy that we had really had the opportunity to do anything we wanted, and we did what we did because we understood the rules to have been written that way, and many people did. And I think it's just the Academy is in a difficult position. They're a large organization looked at by the whole world. They've got a real bright light shining on them. And even in a situation like ours, where there was a margin of confusion that arose around their introduction of new rules, they simply didn't feel that they could take that step of recognizing that the film was eligible and that they had to deem us ineligible because even though there had been a misunderstanding and even though their rules were perhaps less than clear for many people, they felt that in all fairness they couldn't allow the film to be eligible. Obviously, I don't support that decision, but I do respect the direction that the Academy is trying to head in. I hope they go further and they do make it possible for films like mine to qualify, lest the Academy find itself, again, this year, as in other years, not necessarily having the best representation of films in theaters that are having a true U.S. theatrical life. And also, they've opened themselves up to exploitation by U.S. television companies who simply have to play by a certain number of token rules and then satisfy Academy requirements when really they're being made by TV companies for TV release here.
Yeah.
So there's a moment here where I hope the Academy goes farther in looking inward and keeping pace with the financing realities that documentaries face, particularly if they're of politically complex subject matter.
Right. You've obviously done a lot of deep thinking about the Iraq War and where we are now. Just stepping back from the film for a second, what would you foresee would be happening in Iraq, let's say, 5 years from now? Are we still going to be there, do you think?
I think we definitely will. I mean, as you may or may not know, we are currently in the process of completing the construction of 14 permanent bases in the country of Iraq. There's a line in my film that I think is unfortunately hauntingly true, which is that Chalmers Johnson says, we know we did not have an exit strategy in the invasion of Iraq because we didn't intend to leave. There is no question that the geostrategic advantage of having a U.S. presence in great proximity to the second largest reserve of oil in the world is a strategic imperative within the minds of some thinkers in Washington who are in power, and that is not Republicans or Democrats, it's both. Jimmy Carter, for example, was one who had created a presidential directive allowing for and accounting for the establishment of U.S. bases across the oil-rich Middle East, and it has been an imperative in the minds of strategic thinkers in Washington for very long to continue to establish an American footprint in that region. And so of the many reasons that I think we went to war in Iraq, certainly one very strong one was an establishment of a new power base in the very strategically useful area between Iran and Saudi Arabia, which is what Iraq occupies. And the establishment of a presence there means that for sure the United States will be there. Now, what the shape of that will be is a little bit up to the Iraqi people. I mean, we have been told by this administration, as we've sometimes been told half-truths by past administrations, but the current half-truth is that what we are doing is first and foremost exporting democracy. I am not one who believes you can drop democracy from a B-2 bomber. I think if you can drop democracy that way, the very meaning of democracy itself, something that's supposed to come out of all of us and not be dropped on us, is in question. And so I don't trust the import or export of democracy like that. I think it has to come from within. But we are told by policymakers that that's what they're trying to do. And I dare say that what I think frightens me is that it is in the process of having implemented that exercise in democracy, we may have done such great damage to our own democracy here at home that, again, we have undermined the very import of democracy, the very values of democracy that we are looking to promote. But I think if the Iraqi people, and I hope this can be the case as anyone should hope this can be the case, if the Iraqi people can find in the rubble of this tragic misadventure the tools to build a society of dignity, self-respect, and most of all, self-definition that is respectful of the needs of human beings and is respectful of the values of the sort of global tradition of democracy, That is something for which we can all hope and cheer. What I fear, of course, is that the same imperatives driving U.S. policymakers in Washington may find that choices made in the democratic processes in a country like Iraq do not suit the United States, and therefore they fall afoul of strategic imperatives, as we found in the 60s and 70s, for example, when, for example, Henry Kissinger, in my previous film, The Trials of Henry Kissinger, is quoted after the democratic elections in Chile in 1973. He is quoted as saying, you know, they've elected a communist leader, and he says, how can we stand by and let a country go communist simply due to the irresponsibility of its people? And that was his reflection of his own sort of disregard for democracy when it doesn't suit the national interest of the United States. So, short answer is, I hope for democracy for the Iraqi people, and as anyone should, and I hope they find it in the rubble of this misadventure, but I fear that what they may find may prove to be of ongoing contention and concern for U.S. policymakers who may end up trying to manage the situation in an ongoing fashion in a way that continues to intervene in the sovereignty of another land.
In short, U.S. servicemen are going to be continued to get picked off, blown up, maimed, and otherwise killed pretty regularly for the foreseeable future with no end in sight.
Everything we know about the lack of war planning and the lack of post-war planning, especially in this conflict, should suggest that the same policymakers who were willing to forsake our service people in going to war probably have not had a self-reformation overnight, where suddenly in the post-war they mean to show our men and women the kind of dignity they deserve. And tragically, I hope that is not the case, but I fear that it is. And growingly, as we see dissension among the ranks toward policymakers in Washington, I think we are seeing that the military itself realizes and recognizes in a growing fashion that they have been misused, and that being sent into battle without armor, being sent into battle without an exit strategy, and being sent into a battle, after all, for fictitious reasons and tragically misguided policy, is a process which is ongoing, and there is no end in sight for them. And I hate to say that, because in the making of the film, we've come to know many servicemen and women, and I understand how deeply and personally they take the matter of war and their involvement in it. And to see their hopes and aspirations exploited and instrumentalized by those in power who, after all, don't hear the shots fired and don't hear the cries is tragic and just simply heartbreaking.
There are two films that I have recently seen that are kind of echo, to some extent, what your film is about. One is Ridley Scott's Kingdom of Heaven.
Yep.
Have you seen that?
I have not.
It's about the arrogant Christian, European Christian view that, you know, we are doing God's bidding, which is pretty much what George Bush has basically said he believes he's doing over there. He feels that he's an agent of the Almighty in doing a rather profound spiritual religious task, which is to bring freedom to that area of the world.
You know me, Jeffrey, I'm not a Bush basher, and I'm not a Bush basher only because whether I agree or disagree with Mr. Bush's policies, he was not born overnight. George Bush, whatever one feels about him, everyone thinks, what an anomaly, what a departure from past traditions in U.S. foreign policy. What you learn from my film and what I learned in the making of it is that, tragically, George Bush and his administration and their policy of preemptive war and their policy of a really firm American hand in the global space is really more a shrill extension of past traditions and impulses in U.S. foreign policy than some great exception from it. And I think if we are too preoccupied with George Bush, we will miss the bigger issue, the much bigger question, the elephant in the room, which is that this is a country that was founded as a republic. It broke off from an empire, and the idea was to form a modest republic in the Western Hemisphere, and it was Washington himself who warned us about the kind of foreign entanglements that leads to empire, the need for a standing army to protect the borders of an empire, all the lessons that were learned from the unfolding of the British Empire. And over time, what has happened to this country is that through a number of circumstances, including global opportunities that befell the United States and our geostrategic position and other advantages that we earned and that befell us, we have suddenly become the most powerful country in the world. And we find ourselves in a new age where suddenly we are like the empires of old, and we face many of the same challenges, and we are walking in the footsteps of empires that, as we know too well, come and go. We know how that story ends. And so what I want Americans to think most deeply about is that we are at a crossroads where we have to ask ourselves who we are as a country, where we came from, and is it more important to us to seize the kind of imperial gains that we are looking for around the world, or is it more important to us to adhere to our founding Republican principles, our principles of self-government? Because as we can see from the simple example of the Iraq War, that adventure, in order to, quote, bring democracy, quote, to Iraq, cost us so greatly the fabric of our own democracy here at home, that it's a demonstration project in what Washington warned us about and what Dwight Eisenhower warned us about, that the kind of economic interests, what Eisenhower called plundering for our own ease and convenience, the precious resources of tomorrow, that those acts of plunder by an empire, they come at the cost of the very fabric of our democratic ideals. And they come at the cost, if you have to lie to the public to go to war, then you are going to war at the cost of your democracy. Because lying to the public is an erosion of public trust, which is so fundamental to the delicate balance of checks and balances in our system. And so that is what concerns me, and that's what I would want every American to think about. And it doesn't matter who's in the Oval Office. Whoever's there, they've got the same phone number, and the people who need to call that phone know the number.
All right, well, leaving aside then the George Bush's seeming belief that there is a spiritual component to his beliefs about what is going on in Iraq.
I'm not trying to make light of that, Jeffrey. I'm just saying the system is so powerful that George Bush isn't a useful idiot. He's a useful zealot. You know, it happens that his brand is religion. That's how he fits into the paradigm. But I would argue that if it weren't George Bush being a religious person, it might have been somebody else who was a free marketeer. It might have been somebody else who wanted to see the spread of classical music across the Arab world. He was a violinist. It wouldn't matter. Mm. It just matters that whatever his particular platform is, it fits in a haunting fashion, of course, because of the Crusades and our historical context and the conflict between Eastern and Western peoples, that it fits so neatly in, and it plays on so many public feelings. I think for all the public feelings it plays on, what you see in George Bush's way of thinking is the same as in many ways what you see across the sea, which is a form of fundamentalism. Fundamentalism, after all, is a commitment to cling to old ideas, notwithstanding the arrival of new ones. It's a rejection of the new, and it sticks to the old and fundamental. And that's what dinosaurs do, and then they become extinct. And this is why I don't put so much weight in whether George Bush has what are ultimately outmoded ideas. He is just useful in that fashion. And so I look past him at the system that found that so useful that he found his way out of alcoholism through religion and became a very zealous devotee of his God.
That's actually one of the things I really respect about the guy, is having you know, gotten off booze and, you know, turned the corner in his life. I respect anybody who's gone through that. So.
I think most people usually mention it, and I hope I didn't just do it. Most people usually mention his alcoholism as a way of throwing a little barb at him. I share your view. I think that whatever it takes for someone to find personal growth and a step forward in the world is their private business, and we all struggle with frailties that we have, and hopefully we find some mechanisms for getting forward in this complicated life. The danger, of course, for George Bush is the assumption that what is good for him is good for others, that what he believes is what others should believe. Whenever you take that view, you take a view that is counter to the history of and tradition of democracy. Democracy does not believe that. It believes that each of our view matters and should contribute to a public forum that should not be hijacked by the powerful, derailed by it, or undermined by it.
Another film that seems almost like a companion piece, certainly has a lot of thematic, shares certain themes, is Syriana, Stephen Gagan film. Did you happen to catch that one?
I did. It's an honor to be mentioned in the same sentence. It's an excellent film.
So I take it you're, yeah. He spoke to Richard Perle also as part of his research, as you have in your film here.
Yes. And so it's kind of take the analogy of a bully in the prison yard. You know, the bully's been there forever. He's in for life. There's a bunch of other prisoners, straggly guys sitting around. And every now and then somebody gets restless, and the bully has to make a show of him. So this time they hit our buildings, and the bully got up, and he decided to choose the weakest, easiest guy he could take in the yard. And he chose Saddam Hussein, and he knocked him around and knocked him to the ground. And the whole idea was that he'd go back to his perch and everybody'd be very impressed. The trouble, of course, is that that country got back up. And so suddenly, what was meant to be a demonstration project in American power actually became a demonstration of American weakness, of the inapplicability of our arsenal to deal with the kind of world we're living in, let alone to deal with a fourth-rate crumbling power like Iraq that had no weapons. And so what this has said to the larger, more serious threats that we might face in the world is that, in fact, the U.S. is far less ready than they may have thought we were before we showed our hand. And so this has been, I would argue, a great strategic error, because it's like Laurence Olivier once said, never sing your highest note on stage, because people might hear your voice break, and then they know your limit. Mm-hmm. Well, here's what I think we've done. We sung too high a note, our voice cracked, and the whole world has heard it.
That's very well said. You're often a very well-spoken gentleman. I really love talking to you, Gene. Thank you for your time. And I want to just remind everybody listening that Why We Fight will open on January 20th. And I don't know how many theaters, Eugene.
It opens in New York and Los Angeles on the 20th, and then some days later, the 27th, it widens out to a number of other cities and then continues to widen into February 10th. And please come see the film. This is a film meant to really inspire everybody to join a public dialogue that isn't partisan and it isn't the usual, he's right and he's wrong, and these are good guys and those are bad guys. This is something that affects all of us.
I completely concur. The site, by the way, is www.sonyclassics.com/why we
Well, you can actually go to www.whywefight.com.
Okay.
Plain
fine.
And simple.
All right. Very simple.
Whywefight.com. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jeffrey.
You're welcome.